Welcome to session 221. I receive God's in embryo, the Mormon doctrine of human deification. Thank you. My name is Hugo Olias. I'm the news editor for Sansa Magazine. I don't know where the moderator of the session is. I don't know where my respondent is. But I have a long paper. I passed some flyers with my quotes. I made only 40 copies. If you don't have one, I invite you to sit with someone who does have one and share if you want to follow that with me. And I just want to say thank you, Dixon, for coming. Someone who sponsored me 20 years to come to BYU as a graduate student is here. Thank you for coming, Dixon. Gee, this wasn't in the program. There's something profoundly ironic about the fact that I'm presenting a paper on what could be called a theological issue. The irony is that most of my years attending Sandstone, I have avoided theological issues. If there was a theological session on Seasons North, you will usually find me on Seasons South. If there's a theological session on Seasons South, you will usually find me on Seasons North. And if all the planets align against me with theology, both in Seasons North and Seasons South, you will usually find me in the lobby, gabbing with a friend. Things began to change for me in the year 2000 when I read for the first time the groundbreaking article by Thomas Alexander on the reconstruction of Mormon doctrine. Reading that article, I realized that while philosophical discussions about God and religion can be arcane and tedious, the history of how doctrines of Mormonism have developed and changed over the years is quite fascinating. My purpose seems simple enough: to track the discourse around the Mormon doctrine of human deification. Yet there is, I am afraid, another dimension to the issue which complicates immensely my task, and is how the doctrine of human deification fits into a larger theological landscape. Let me explain. If the expression human deification sounds strange to our ears, it is because in Mormonism we prefer to use other expressions, such as exaltation and especially eternal progression. I have considered and rejected both expressions as part of the title for my paper. I have rejected the expression exaltation because when we use that term in Mormonism, we have very little to say about what it means to be exalted and a lot to say about the requirements to be exalted. Those of you who were earlier at Jess Grossbeck's session know all about that. Another expression that I seriously considered for the title of this presentation was eternal progression, but I discarded it because eternal progression is a philosophical notion and embraces many more concepts in the Mormon landscape. Eternal progression is a framework that can help us understand the doctrine of deification, but it is also a framework for other theological ideas, including the plurality of worlds, or Mormon cosmology, the plurality of gods, or polytheism, and the Mormon concept of eternal increase, of having an infinite number of spirit children. These concepts are related to human deification because they all fall under the umbrella of eternal progression. Yet human deification is distinct from other concepts I have named. Let me mention just a few additional borderline theological notions which are part of the same general landscape. First, there is the issue of what some Mormons are now calling Mormon theogony, that is, a theology about the origin of God. Needless to say, traditional Christianity doesn't have a theogony because, simply put, traditional Christianity does not believe in a finite God. God has always been God. And even if it is possible to use some scriptures from the Bible to argue that humans can become God, what some Christians have called the doctrine of theosis, it is more problematic to argue conversely that God was once human. Second, there is the doctrine of pre-existence, or more generally, the origin of humankind. Third, there is what I call the issue of thearchy, that is, the hierarchy that those gods have in a potentially infinite number of worlds and heavens. 19th century leaders of the church had much to say about the thearchy, but today's leaders ignore the subject. Even though the concept of human deification can be traced back somewhat earlier in Joseph Smith's teachings, the Kingfolio discourse is where the doctrine really came to its own. There's an anecdote about B.H. Roberts, who, while visiting a state conference, made reference to the King Follett discourse in one of his talks. A member approached him after the meeting and asked him to show him the King Follett discourse in the sixth volume of the documentary History of the Church, which Roberts himself had compiled. Roberts opened the book and found, to his astonishment, that the discourse wasn't there, that the 16 pages of that volume had been censored. The main point that I want to draw at this point of that anecdote is that the Kingfolio discourse has a textual history which is complicated by the existence of multiple scribes and by the fact that the church has traditionally felt ambivalent about its contents. Paraphrasing Lorenzo Snow, I am tempted to say that where theology once was, correlation now is. As correlation now is, theology will never, ever become. Due in part to acts of censorship, it wasn't until 1978 that we had a complete, reliable version of what Joseph Smith said in the Kingfolio discourse. Equally important to what Joseph Smith said in the Kingfolio discourse is what he did not say. And the most conspicuous absence is that Joseph Smith doesn't say that God is the father of our spirits, nor does he say that we lived as a family in the premortal life. Now, there's some second and some third-hand evidence that he may have taught something about the Heavenly Mother. If such is the case, then it would be possible to assume that he understood God as our literal premortal father. But the record is, in my opinion, inconclusive. The second important silence of the Kingfolio discourse is about family life in the post-mortal existence. The phrase, families can be together forever, is ubiquitous in the church today. But I do not find evidence that Joseph Smith taught that living in heaven means living with the children and the grandchildren that you have on this earth. Mormons today vacillate between two competing visions of the afterlife. In the first one, you and your spouse, or your plural spouses, spend eternity sitting on thrones of glory, creating worlds and procreating spiritual children forever. In the second, you and your spouse spend eternity sitting in your living room, with your earthly children and grandchildren around you in some kind of perpetual family home evening. The first vision is cosmic and is consistent with Mormon beliefs in the days of Brigham Young, John Taylor, and Wilford Woodruff. The second vision is domestic and reflects the teachings of David O. McKay, Spencer W. Kimball, and Gordon Hinckley. There is another silence in the Kingfolio discourse. Joseph Smith goes as far back as to say that God was once a man, but doesn't delve any further into the past. However, Brigham Young, Heber C. Kimball, and Orson Pratt filled in the picture by affirming a potentially infinite chain of pre-Earth heavenly ancestors. This infinite chain was defended by George Buchanan and Joseph William Smith, but more recent LDS writers have suggested that it might not be an appropriate subject to delve into because it can make us miss the mark. The three main characters in the Kingfolio discourse are God the Father, Jesus Christ, and man. In one of the most crucial passages of the discourse, Joseph Smith quotes and misquotes the Gospel of John. Building on language borrowed from the Johannine writings, Joseph Smith says that when Jesus died and rose again, he was following a pattern established by the Father, who, and here's where Joseph Smith misquotes or goes beyond the Johannine text, also died and rose again before Jesus Christ. And then we get to the axis of the issue. Quote 1. Here then is eternal life, to know the only wise and true God. You have got to learn how to make yourselves gods in order to save yourselves and be kings and priests to God, the same as all gods have done, by going from a small capacity to a great capacity, from a small degree to another, from grace to grace until the resurrection of the dead, from exaltation to exaltation, till you are able to sit in everlasting burning and everlasting power and glory as those who have gone before you sit enthroned. Note that the Kingfolio discourse does not describe deification in terms of children who grow up to become like their fathers. like her parents. Rather, Smith's language summons up an image more like that of an apprentice mason who is initiated into a path of knowledge and progresses degree by degree until reaching the highest thrones. The implications of the King Follett discourse are phenomenal. It set the course for a new theology, a new cosmology, and a new doctrine of salvation. Exaltation is less an end point than a perpetual path toward progress. God the Father and the Son are no longer static or absolute. They are two in a possibly infinite chain of gods who follow one another to greater and greater heights. When we move from a lower degree to a higher degree, we add to the glory of God and potentially to the glory of all the gods who came before. I was reading this to a friend recently and she said, "Gee, it's like a pyramid scheme." Only 2 months after delivering his most famous speech, Joseph Smith was killed and the majority of the saints under the leadership of Brigham Young and the 12 resettled in the West. LDS theology, which under Joseph Smith had been a musical solo played by a virtuoso, became under Brigham Young's direction more of a chaotic orchestral piece, marked sometimes by loud screeches or by the clash of dissonant instruments, trying but often failing to play the same tune. Brigham Young, John Taylor, and others revised, and some would say completed, Joseph Smith's vision by stating clearly that God is the Father of our spirits, and that we, therefore, are gods in embryo. Quote 2. "We look at man as emanating from the gods, as a god in embryo, as an eternal being who had an existence before he came here, who will exist after his mortal remains are mingled and associated with dust, from whence he came, and from whence he will be resurrected and partake of that happiness for which he is destined, or receive the reward of his evil deeds, according to circumstances." As Thomas Alexander points out, what we have today in the Church is a product of a doctrine that was reconstructed between 1890 and 1925 by 3 European immigrants, James E. Talmadge, B.H. Roberts, and John A. Widsoe. By the end of the 19th century, B.H. Roberts was given more sophisticated philosophical cast to Brigham Young's ideas that humans are gods in embryo. And John Widsoe, gave one of the boldest explanations about the importance of sexual relations in heaven in a section of his book, Rational Theology, titled Sex Among Gods. At about the same time when these 3 scholars were about to begin their work, Lorenzo Snow helped preserve the essence of the King Follett discourse by composing his famous couplet, "As man is, God once was. As God is, man may become." Lorenzo Snow's dictum came at a crucial time when one of the basic tenets of the King Follett discourse was about to be seriously questioned. In 1911, Lorenzo Snow had been dead for 10 years, and Joseph F. Smith, his successor, was president of the church. B.H. Roberts wanted to include the King Follett discourse in the documentary history of the church. When the book was already typeset, B.H. Roberts left on a 3-month mission tour. Apparently, at this time, at the 11th hour, the First Presidency made the decision to pull the discourse from the volume. Now, I want to clarify that even though some early church leaders doubted the authenticity of the King Follett discourse, that doesn't mean that they doubted the doctrine of human deification. My impression is that what some of their brethren found offensive in the King Follett discourse was not the ultimate destiny of humans, but the doctrine of the origin of God. President Joseph S. Smith and Councillor Anthony H. Lund had reservations about that idea that God had evolved from being a mere mortal. In terms of Lorenzo Snow's famous dictum, the First Presidency was happy with the second half. As God is, man may become. But they never completely accepted the first half of the dictum. As man is, God once was. Author Kendall O. White has argued that in the 20th century, Mormon theologians have aligned themselves more closely with Protestant neo-Orthodox beliefs. This means, among other things, that they distance themselves from the idea of a finite God, to emphasize instead God's absolute power. David O'Mackay is an example of a leader who had no interest in delving into the mysteries of what it may be like to become a god. Instead, he preached a Jesus-centered message and exalted human virtues. McKay wrote once that the goal of humans is to become master, creator, God. But the context of those remarks is not the doctrine of human deification specifically. It was instead the more general notion of eternal progression. For McKay, eternal progression means, above all, that we must develop virtues such as strength, self-discipline, and faith. By the mid-1950s, the doctrine of human deification was still present in church discourse, and general authorities would sometimes touch on it. For instance, in 1956, Hubie Brown of the Quorum of the Twelve said the following, quote 3, "When we say that we may become like our Father, we not mean to humanize God, but rather to deify man, not as he now is, but as he may become. The difference between us is indescribably great, but it is one of degree rather than of kind. Yet in a subsequent paragraph, Hubie Brown also put the doctrine in the vaguer concept of eternal progression. What I mean by vaguer is that church leaders were no longer wanted to talk about gods sitting in thrones of glory, creating worlds, or procreating spiritual children. They preferred instead to talk about how humans can grow in knowledge and develop other virtues as preparation to living with our Heavenly Father." Hubie Brown's quote continues like this, and you have the second part in your flyer. "We believe that in his infinite and eternal development toward a godlike status, man moves toward and through a turnstile called death, that there is no interruption of life at this portal, for eternity is indefinitely prolonged time. We believe that man, after passing through this turnstile, will continue his eternal journey from the point where his actions in this life have brought him. Whatever principle of intelligence we attain unto in this life, it will rise with us in the resurrection. To deny the possibility of eternal progression is to accept the awful alternative of eventual stagnation, which would be damnation." The trend we see emerging from these teachings is clear. Eternal progression, which was the background of human deification, is now put in the foreground. And human deification is put in the background. Even though in some contexts the expression eternal progression functions as a euphemism or code word for human deification, when pressed to describe eternal progression, church leaders simply say that we are destined to grow in knowledge and virtue and eventually live with God. In part, this reticence is likely a reaction to the sensationalization of anti-Mormon propaganda, such as the anti-Mormon film The Godmakers. Another likely motive is a desire, especially since the 1980s, to underscore commonalities with traditional Christians and to ground LDS differences, if any, in less esoteric features of the religion, such as the Book of Mormon. In November 1994, Gordon Hinckley mentioned both the Kim Follett discourse and Lorenzo Snow's couplet in a speech given in General Conference. Quote 4. "The whole design of the gospel is to lead us onward and upward to greater achievement, even eventually to godhood. This great possibility was enunciated by the prophet Joseph Smith in the Kim Follett sermon and emphasized by President Lorenzo Snow. It is this grand and incomparable concept, as God now is, man may become." What is remarkable about this quote is not so much what President Hinckley says as much as what he avoids. Did you notice that the first half of Lorenzo Snow's couplet, the one about God once being a man, is missing? Focusing only on the second half of the couplet, President Hinckley concluded by reaffirming God's absolute power. And the quote continues, "Our enemies have criticized us for believing in this. Our reply is that this lofty concept is in no way diminishes God, the Eternal Father. He is the Almighty. He is the creator and governor of the universe. He is the greatest of all and will always be so. But just as an earthly father wishes for his sons and daughters every success in life, so I believe our Father in heaven wishes for his children, that they might approach him in stature and stand beside him, resplendent in godly strength and wisdom." So for President Hinckley, the second half of the couplet expresses a grand and grandiose concept. What about the first part of the couplet? The San Francisco Chronicle asked President Hinckley exactly that in a 1997 interview. Quote 5. Question. There are some significant differences in your beliefs. For instance, don't Mormons believe that God was once a man? Answer. I wouldn't say that. There was a little couplet coined. As man is, God once was. As God is, man may become. Now, that's more of a couplet than anything else. That gets into some pretty deep theology that we don't know very much about. In 2001, New Yorker reporter Lawrence Wright asked President Hinckley about the doctrine of multiple gods. President Hinckley tried to explain by referring to human deification, but he ended up, like others before him, giving a speech about eternal progression. Lawrence Wright reports, quote 6, "In the Mormon scheme, every person is a potential divinity. The adage, as man now is, God once was, as God now is, man may be, expresses the Mormon belief that God once was a human being with a wife and children." But Hinckley did not seem interested in discussing matters of theology. When I asked him to characterize God's connubial relationships, he replied, "We don't speculate on that a lot." Brigham Young said, "If you went to heaven and saw God, it would be Adam and Eve." I don't know what he meant by that. Pointing to a green faced portrait of the Lion of the Lord, as Brigham Young was called, he said, "There he is, right there. I'm not going to worry about what he said about these things." I asked Hinckley whether Mormon theology was a form of polytheism. I don't have the remotest idea what you mean," he said impatiently. "More than one God?" "Yes, but that's a very loose term," he replied. "We believe in eternal progression." By that, he meant that human beings can evolve toward Godhood by following the Mormon path. "You want to be a reporter always?" he said. "You want to be a scribe forever, through all eternity? We believe that life, eternal life, is real, that it's purposeful, that it has meaning, that it can be realized." I wouldn't describe us polytheistic. Since 1994, when President Hinckley quoted Lorenzo Snow in General Conference, no one in General Conference has ever again quoted the little couplet. The missionary discussions do not say that people can become gods, but rather than those who repent of their sins and receive the ordinances of the gospel will live in God's presence, become like him, and receive a fullness of joy. Conclusion. In the summer of 1913, B.H. Roberts went to David Lyon, who had a printing shop in downtown Salt Lake City, and ordered 10,000 copies of the King Follett Discourse, which he would pay for out of his own pocket. He said that he would give copies to every state president, every branch president, and every bishop he would meet in his travels. Even though the church did eventually add the King Follett Discourse to the documentary history, I have the feeling that it was Joseph F. Smith, not B.H. Roberts, who won the war. Lorenzo Snow's couplet is no longer embraced as a couplet, only as a singlet. Both affirmed and avoided, the King Follett Discourse and Lorenzo Snow's couplet have managed to survive somehow all the presence of the church during the 20th century, from Joseph S. Smith to Gordon B. Hinckley. Will they survive the presidency of Thomas S. Monson? Thank you. I felt confident about this Q&A, knowing that Mike Quinn was going to sit next to me and, you know, jump in and answer any difficult questions. But since he's not here, I will ask you to come to the mic if you have a question, and please talk to the mic so that the question gets recorded in the tape.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could comment on the inclusion of the King Follett Discourse in the new Joseph Smith manual.
Tell us more. Is the current manual?
Yes.
And it has been included?
Yeah.
Okay. Not all of it, just quotes.
Little
The church has a history of presenting little excerpts from the King Foley Discourse. The church has a history of presenting the King Foley Discourse not on its half. And it has a more recent history of talking more about how wonderful the King Foley Discourse is than giving the specifics of the King Foley Discourse that could be embarrassing, right? So, for instance, they talk about how it was the most grandiose talk he ever gave. They talk about how he died just 2 months after giving it, that kind of thing. There's a history of trying to preserve, to a certain extent, the legacy, or at least the reference to the King Foley Discourse.
A question. Do you feel the Adam God doctrine was taught by Joseph Smith in the Nauvoo period? Do you think he was the generator of that? And how much connection do you think that came out of the King Foley Discourse?
Okay, I will answer the second part of the question, which is the one that I feel more comfortable answering, which is that I think it could be argued that what Brigham Young was trying to do, and others at the time of Brigham Young, I use a metaphor in my paper of this orchestral piece that, you know, is out of tune and there's people going different directions. I think that's what happened. Joseph Smith was saying many different things in many different contexts. And I think the trick is how you try to harmonize what he was saying, how to try to put it together. I realize that he just thinks about eternal increase in a different context. Now you put together eternal increase with the Heavenly Mother, which I'm not sure he said anything, with the King Foley Discourse, and you start to find your parallelisms and regularize the system. The system becomes more like something systematic. I'm not an expert on the Adam God theory, but I think it's a good example of how people were trying to interpret what Joseph Smith has said, and that was one possible direction, the one that Brigham Young particularly chose to follow.
After the statements by President Hinckley and the aftermath of that, I came across the YouTube video of Robert Millet giving explanation, I think, to what had occurred, and his point was that we as the church do not have to answer all of our critics' questions. And the question I guess I have for you is, do you think there's going to be, if we're not answering our critics' questions, then we're also not going to be answering our own students' questions eventually? So are you seeing a trajectory of the loss of this particular concept from the church? And second part of the question is, do you, as a person, would you feel this is a personal loss to you in terms of your view of Joseph Smith and his theology if that was to occur?
That's a lot of questions. First let me say something about Robert Millet. I think he's disingenuous. I should say, if church leaders are saying that we don't need to answer the questions from our critics, there is a contradiction there, and it is that many of them are answering these questions and trying to give explanations. Now, Farms is very interesting in showing how there's perfect harmony between the King Foley Discourse and an old Orthodox Christian doctrine called theosis, right? So this is a typical example, you know. So we have to decide, you know. I think it would be fine to say we are not going to answer, right? But it seems to me that we are doing it already. And the question is, well, are we doing it to defend ourselves? Are we doing it to reassure ourselves? For me, it will be a loss. But part of it has to do with this interest, perhaps passion, that I have developed in the last few years with the history of Mormonism. And I think it's a very important part, not only of the past, but of the present. How doctrines change over time, how is very complicated. Armand Moss has talked about how the church doesn't change by disavowal, doesn't change by repudiating anything from the past. The way the church changes is by not mentioning any more certain things and changing the emphasis, right? But it takes a whole generation or several generations because, you know, people in Sunday school still, you know, raise their hands and say things that they heard 20 or 50 years ago.
That actually kind of touches on my question as well. After some of these interviews that you quoted that President Hinckley gave, there was clearly some reaction within the church to what he had said, so much that in general conference he addressed it. And he said, now there have been some reports about what I said to a reporter, and you don't need to think that I don't understand the doctrine of the church, and you know, that there's a difference between what he says to the press and what he says internal to the church. And so it seems like there are different audiences, and that you know, some of what is going on is part of what's hanging on in the general membership of the church, not just at the top levels, but also this interplay between outside and inside emphasis.
I think you're totally right. I just published with Samson a little essay on Gordon B. Hinckley called Gordon B. Hinckley and the Ritualization of Mormon History. And one of the things that I say there is that I see the development of two modes of discourse in the church. One for internal consumption for the members, another for those who are not members, and for the media. And I think that it is only natural that an institution will develop both.
So how does that play into what you're talking about in terms of the emphasis of this particular set of teachings, when you are mixing in your quotes those things that are the external mode of discourse and the internal mode of discourse? Is there a different story within the church than there is to the rest of the world?
It really raises interesting questions. One of the interesting questions is, what is the motivation? Are we embarrassed of what Joseph Smith said? You know, that's ultimately, for me, one of the important questions, and I don't know if I have an answer. I wouldn't go as far as to say that we are embarrassed as a church of what Joseph Smith said, but certainly Gordon B. Hinckley was savvy enough to realize that it is better not to talk about it to non-members.
I was curious to go back to actually the concept, the construct of eternal progression that we talked about at the beginning of your talk that you seem to be very passionate about. In 1846 or 47 on the trail, William Clayton was with a group of people that were sitting around a campfire and discussed, somebody brought up the topic of baby resurrection. The word reincarnation wasn't really used until much later. Later on, Eliza R. Snow told her brother that she believed in reincarnation and believed that she had been taught that by her husband, Joseph Smith. Presuming that that may be correct, or a possibility, would that figure in to the idea of eternal progression step by step?
Yeah, there's two things that I would mention. The first one is the most censored part of the King Follett discourse, which is the part where Joseph Smith talks about, and the only part where he talks about women, and he's talking specifically about women as mothers, and he says, mothers, you will have your infant children who died, and the way they're going to be is they're going to be little children as they were. They are never going to grow up, but as little children they will be part of this heavenly kingdom, and they will have their own thrones and their own exaltations as little babies, or little children. That, of course, was very early removed through the 20th century was removed, and that part was not considered. You know, if we are talking during the polygamy era, it was so important that one of the requirements was to get married. You know, and this idea of little children in thrones of glory, that was something that very soon they removed. Now, the second concept, this idea of what some people call reincarnation, other people call it multiple probations. I can see how some of the things that Joseph Smith said in the King Follett discourse could have led Brigham Young, perhaps when he talks about Adam and Eve having been, you know, in a previous life, gods, and coming here to this earth. I can see how you can take some things, and I have seen that done here in Samson a couple of years ago, take little quotes here and there from the King Follett discourse and say, okay, this is really reincarnation. This is what Joseph Smith is talking about.
Yeah.
Thank you. I really enjoyed this. The first time that I ever heard about the King Floyd Discourse was in fifth grade. I grew up in Alabama as the only Mormon in my school, and most of my friends are Baptists. Hmm. And so they had heard about the King Floyd Discourse long before I had. And I was sitting at lunch with them, and they were telling me how Mormons believe they can become gods. And I was like, what? I had never heard of that. I did a little bit of preliminary research, I guess, to try to understand what they were saying. And I guess something I've noticed with a number of the, I guess, less Protestant theologies of Mormonism, the more unique theologies, let's say, or things that are potentially embarrassing, like, for example, Brigham Young's statements on blacks or things like that, tend to remain much longer in the non-Mormon or critical of Mormonism sources than they tend to be in Mormon sources, at least in common distribution. I was wondering, as a historian or for the subject of history, if there is any unique usefulness or what the challenges maybe would be of those sorts of things remaining, maybe much longer in non-Mormon or what I guess would be called anti-Mormon sources for purposes of historical research.
Well, definitely. I wouldn't say anything against people who really helped us find documentation. The Tanners made a career out of it. Brother Tanner, I will call him that, was honored last year in a session in Sandstone because of his contributions to materials that are hard to obtain. So definitely, the anti-Mormon movement has a very important role in helping us think more about who we are. And when you remove the critical component, you can make something positive out of it, I'm sure. Hi, Quinn. When is the session supposed to end? What time?
11 o'clock.
So we have, let me see, 20 minutes. I will
My question's very short.
Okay, what I would like to do is to interrupt the questions. And I'm sure that Mike Quinn read my paper because I emailed to him last week and he told me he read it. I would invite him to talk to us because he knows a lot more about Mormonism than I do. Is that okay?
Yes, great. May I ask a short question first, just for clarification?
I'm sorry. Okay, yes. No. And Mike will catch his breath. Meanwhile.
No, if there's time
after. Okay, afterwards. Okay. Thank you, Mike, for coming and responding. I appreciate so much your willingness to do this.
Sorry. I won't bore you with a set of excuses, but I deeply apologize to Hugo for not being here on time. I thought I was going to be arriving early. Okay. Hugo Olaze makes two very important distinctions between traditional Christianity and the official teachings of 19th century Mormonism. First, traditional Christianity does not have a concept of theogony, or the origin of God. Second, traditional Christianity does not have a concept that there is a hierarchy of gods, which Hugo calls thearchy. To Jews, Muslims, and traditional Christians, those were and are the doctrines... Oh, thank you. The doctrines of heathens, such as the ancient Egyptians, Greeks, Romans, and Canaanites, as well as current polytheists, such as Hindus. However, despite Jewish and Muslim opposition to polytheism, Christians have been even more vociferous and violent against those polytheistic ideas and worshipers because of Christian belief in a divine Trinity. The more that ancient Romans and Greeks said that Christians were polytheistic due to the Christian Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, the more Christians, lacking any rational or logical rebuttals, were willing to die or kill to prove that their three gods were actually one God. What ancient Christians could not achieve logically to defend their doctrines as monotheism, they achieved in blood, by martyrdom or murder. This is a heritage that underlines evangelical Protestant hatred for Mormonism. And you will never understand anti-Mormonism in past or present if you do not recognize that Mormon views of God cause revulsion to most Catholics and Protestants and cause a gut-level hatred in evangelical Protestants who have published 99% of anti-Mormon literature. Led by Apostle Prophet Gordon B. Hinckley since the mid-1970s, and aided by BYU religion professors like Stephen Robinson, LDS headquarters has tried to strengthen political alliances with evangelical Protestants in America's culture wars. By de-emphasizing or denying the 19th century Mormon doctrines about God, deity, and a hierarchy of gods, including the earth's humans who have already become gods, which printed pronouncements of Joseph Smith and Brigham Young, identified as Adam, the first man, and Abraham, the father of monotheistic religions, to name only two of the already deified mortals in Mormon theology. As Olaus rightly observes, implicit in current Mormon use of the word exaltation is the doctrine that there is a hierarchy of gods, which, for convenience, Mormons, faithful Mormons, identify as Father in Heaven first, Jesus Christ, Jehovah second, Holy Ghost third, followed by whispered gods, Adam, Noah, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and extending to the most recent recipient of the ordinances of endowment and sealing in any LDS temple throughout the world. If LDS leaders and BYU professors continue to downplay or deny those fundamental LDS doctrines in order to maintain political alliances with evangelical Christians, then the LDS Church will surrender its birthright for a mess of pottage.
We have 15 minutes. We'll retake the questions.
Direct them to him.
There's another woman, wasn't
there? Yeah, there was a lady who wanted to ask something.
You go ahead first.
Well, I'm going to be long, so why don't you go ahead?
My question is short. It's just that in the recent few years, I've read a few people who know a great deal more than I do about church history, especially Joseph Smith years, and they have made a point of saying that Joseph Smith actually had W.W. Phelps do his ghostwriting, and they have named the King Follett Discourse and a couple of political speeches and the Green Mountain Boys speech and so on as having been ghostwritten. All I want to know is your opinion about that, because I really don't know.
Well, I cannot talk in general, but I will talk specifically about the King Follett Discourse. I think Joseph Smith had an incredible, incredible religious imagination, as Harold Bloom put it. His creative imagination, his creative powers were tremendous. How he developed this gift to give speeches, you know, extemporaneously, how he would combine new ideas, how he would absorb new ideas and just come up with these bold, audacious concepts. I kind of think that Phelps was behind doing that. No, and I mean, the evidence of Joseph Smith standing and giving that speech, I think there's like five different scribes, people who were there taking notes, different notes, and you know, then the work of trying to put together what he really said. So, yeah, that's my answer.
When I was on my mission in Germany more years ago than I care to discuss, we got a visit from then Apostle Gordon B. Hinckley, which was really exciting to us. And in the course of the discussion, someone asked him about the atonement. About did the atonement happen on the cross, or did it happen in the Garden of Gethsemane, or what? And Elder Hinckley proceeded to tell us that it happened on the cross, which caused me to scratch my head, because I heard all along that it, the Mormon Church teaches it was in the Garden of Gethsemane.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but he insisted it was on the cross. And then I fast forward to these Larry King and other media interviews, and I'm thinking, I don't know that I believe there's two dialogues going on in the church. I believe that Gordon B. Hinckley is not a theologian. He's a PR man. And he doesn't necessarily know the doctrine that well. I think the interviews in front of the media were spin, and I think the statements across the General Conference podium was damage control. And I do believe the church considers this doctrine, this couplet from Lorenzo Snow, to be an embarrassment.
Okay.
And I'm thinking, well, I'm wondering what's happened to the church I grew up in. Where is all the unique doctrine going? Are we going to become a Me Too Christian church? I mean, the reorganized church did it. Herbert W. Armstrong's Worldwide Church of God did it. Is the Mormon Church next?
Hey, I think I have feelings of agreement with the general concept of what you're saying, and yet I also have a critique of what you said. And it's that if you say that Gordon B. Hinckley didn't know the doctrine of the church, the pre-assumption is that there is a doctrine of the church. And I think that what we have is really Joseph Smith going in different directions, opening, if you wish, opening different windows of a big room, and the light that comes into the room is different colors. And then from that rainbow, if you wish, different leaders in the rest of the 19th century trying to fighting, you know, Brigham Young fighting with Orson Pratt, or some fights with Amasa Lyman, you know, whether the atonement is crucial or not, whether God's absolute powers are limited by some of the ideas of the King Follett discourse or not. And then you have the reconstruction, what Thomas Alexander calls the reconstruction, these more scholarly types in the early 20th century trying to put together, writing a lot of the literature that has been so foundational to what we now read, but also behind the scenes having debates, you know, Joseph Smith reading the draft for Rational Theology and sending a telegram to Salt Lake City, you know, whether this idea that Witzowick's expressing is too crazy or not, and Beard to Roberts wanting the King Follett discourse included, and Anthon Land or others perhaps thinking differently. So that is really Mormon doctrine, I think. If that is Mormon doctrine, then it's not a unity, it's a diversity of ideas.
Thanks for your presentations. Just one clarification on when President Hinckley got up in conference and kind of said, hey, I know what we teach. But he didn't say to the conference what we believe. He said, I know what we believe, don't worry. But he didn't outline it, and maybe my mind goes too far, but I thought maybe he wants to leave it open for everybody's individual interpretation, which is really maybe a spectrum. Maybe a lot of people in the church don't really know you know, what was originally taught, and he wanted to leave it open. Just a point. He never nailed that down.
That's a good concept. I read somewhere, sometime in Sanskrit, that you never know the religion of a seminary teacher, right? And it's true. It's true. I don't know if I should say this, but my father was an Israeli director. And once I was taping an interview, as a good Mormon boy, I was taping an interview with him for family history purposes. And he told me that he never really felt comfortable with the Pearl of Great Price, you know. So that's true. The other thing that I wanted to say in reference to your comment is that that was a rhetorical move that President Hinckley did several times, you know. I think he did it once with evolution. He said, I've been through this, I have studied it, just... And you don't know if he's saying, you know, take my word, you know, that yes, that there's no problem, or if he's saying all of you should go through this and study it and come to your own personal conclusion. And Mike wanted to add something.
That conference talk that President Hinckley gave, I'll say what I think he was doing, and then I'll suggest what he might have thought he was doing. I think he was saying implicitly to the audience in the large assembly hall, and who were gathered also in the tabernacle and throughout the world watching, Mormons who had been endowed, Mormons who had read the Doctrine and Covenants, particularly Section 132 and 131, I was thinking he was saying to them, there's an 800-pound gorilla standing by me. I don't need to tell you what that 800-pound gorilla of our doctrine concerning God is. We all know it. But he might have thought he was saying to the audience, there's a mad aunt in the attic, and I don't want to talk about her.
Yes. Okay. Yeah.
Either one of you could comment on my question. It's my understanding that the Eastern Orthodox idea of theosis that you kind of mentioned and touched on is very similar to the Mormon idea of eternal progression. And I'm just wondering, it doesn't seem like obviously there's not many Eastern Orthodox Christians around here in the United States, but they don't seem to get this anti-Christian label that Mormons do. And I'm just wondering how similar you think the idea of theosis is to eternal progression.
Farms is making now a big deal out of this. And in fact, they recently published a revised version of, I think it was a master's thesis by a former, if I remember correctly, Orthodox Catholic priest who converted to Mormonism. I think that Farms was more interested in the whole thing because the guy converted to Mormonism. I think that there are similarities and there are also many differences. My short answer would be, if you believe that God is a concept, if you understand eternal progression as becoming one with God, and you don't believe that we have bodies, you know, of flesh and bones, that we will are resurrected beings, that God is a resurrected being. If you remove all those things that the leaders of the church have been teaching for so many years, if you remove all that, then yes, you will find similarities between theosis and human deification as taught in the King Follett Discourse. That would be my short answer.
Well, aside from Eastern Orthodox theological views about theosis, there's also a Romantic tradition that you can find in English poetry. I'm not as familiar with other traditions of poetry on this matter, but of English poets who spoke about humans becoming like God, humans gaining qualities of God. But the distinctions, I think, are very important in that, as I understand even Eastern Orthodox theology on this matter, and even the Romantic poets, they weren't saying that humans would become the equivalent of God. They maintained their belief and their affirmation of the supremacy of God. It was to be godlike is not the same as to be God. And I think that's the distinction. The similarities that can be found in Eastern Orthodox theology and even in Romantic poets on this issue can be blurred, and I imagine Farms will blur them. But it is quite a different thing to believe in becoming God-like and to believe in becoming a God who is supreme, who even can populate worlds and become the supreme arbiter of those worlds and the father of another savior for those worlds. And that's a very different theology. And I think that we must recognize that those kinds of parallels with Mormonism fall short, and crucially short. I think I'm not overstating it, that Mormon views of the origin of God and the potential of humans becoming gods have only one parallel, and that's in the Greek-Roman views of the origin of the gods, that the gods were not always gods, that they were born, they became gods, and the idea that humans could become gods in a very real sense, just like Zeus or Jupiter. And I don't see any other parallels in Christian, Jewish, Muslim views, and even in Romantic literature, about deification.
We have about 2 minutes left. John wanted to make a... How long is it going to take you to say something? 1 minute? We have 1 minute for one more.
Do you think that today Brigham Young's prophecy is coming true, that persecution would not cease against this church until we have become one with the world? Are we now in that state, or do we have some hope that there is still some little persecution left? Particularly if you think we're sliding too much like the Catholic Church did in the beginning, the early church. Are we not now creating Christuses all over all the visitor centers throughout the world? And we're making graven images.
I don't have any problem with the church that focuses on Jesus, because that's a part of the gospel, of the message of the Bible that I get the most, the part about Jesus. So I personally don't have any problem with that. John wanted to make a little statement, and I think apologize for not being here moderating as he should have earlier.
Actually, Hugo, I was hoping no one had noticed. Thank you. I just want to talk to you very briefly about the Mapping Mormon Issues Project that is sort of the father of the paper that I didn't get to hear Hugo read. A year ago, we were kind of brainstorming on if there was a need and a service that Sunstone can uniquely provide. And if you think about the information that's available on the internet today, ex-Mormon or anti-Mormon literature and essays are very prevalent. They're probably the most prevalent of anything on the internet. And then Farron Farms and others have come up with their important role in trying to provide apologetics. But when we were brainstorming last year about the unique role that Sunstone can play, with the motto being faith-seeking understanding, we came up with this idea of what if we could write 10 or 20 position papers that allowed someone to say, we're trying to put forth a treatment of an issue that tries its best to not have any one agenda or motive other than to sort of lay out the facts and provide someone with an understanding of what a particular issue might be it polygamy, be it blacks in the priesthood, be it women's issues, be it this question about God and embryo. And so the Callisters, Rhonda and Michael Callister, were kind enough to give an initial donation towards this project, where we would find some of the best scholars within the Sunstone community or the dialogue community to write these position papers that, again, wouldn't have an axe to grind, but we're trying to just say, shed everything, let's talk about what the issue is, to bring people up to speed, to help them understand what the issues are. And that's what the Mapping Mormon Issues Project is about. We need, Sunstone needs your help to support this issue, because if we can pay these good people to take the time to do a really good job to say, what are the best dialogue articles? What are the best Sunstone articles? What are the best elements in church history that we can provide? Maybe even a bibliography for people to read. We could try and provide this neutral source and place for people to just come to understand the issues without feeling like they're being pulled in one direction or another. And so, for those of you who are willing or able, there's some yellow pages back there on the table. But matching donations are being requested by Sunstone so that they can gather some money. Know that your dollars will be doubled by those who have already contributed in these matching funds. Your dollars can go towards creating a position paper on women in the church, a position paper on homosexuality in the church, a position paper on, pick your topic, on masonry. And those position papers can be a guide and a resource that sort of brings together the past 30 years of Mormon studies into something that's digestible for someone who's new to the issue, because we don't think that that exists. So if any of you believe in that type of cause, please consider contributing to Sunstone through these little yellow pages in the back. And I think we can create a library of resources that will really help future generations find their way. So thank you very much. And thank you to Michael and to Hugo.